Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. And I pre-recorded a program for you before the storm so that when I'm in my home, which I am, and helping with the big cleanup, which is huge, in the area where I'm at, my ranch in southern Florida, there's no electricity, no internet, no way of communicating unless I drive way off the beach and on my cell phone make a call. That's what I'm doing now. But the nice part of this is that all the my staff, all the animals that I care for and try to find homes for and rescue are all healthy, and no damage to any of the property except for the foliage. How much? Well, if you were to make a stack 6 feet high and 6 foot wide, it would fill 4 football fields. That's a lot of stuff. The good news is that of the 5,000 palm trees, probably only lost about 10. Most was bougainvillea and ficus and smaller shrubs and softwood trees. But everything is getting back to normal. It'll take about a week and a half to 2 weeks until it's, you know, it's just another experience. A lot to learn from it. I hope you listened last night to my show on Progressive Commentary Hour about how to survive a disaster. Because when I went out today, not a place, not a single place had generators, fans, water, nothing. In fact, at the few stores open, they had police inside because they were fearful of rioting, and also at the filling stations. Every filling station had a line 1 to 2 miles long. And, of course, that meant that they would be running out of gas. The police were there, but there were no problems. So people have been acting civil and understanding. So I look forward to having an upcoming wonderful experience with you all down at the retreat. And also I believe that from today's program, we now have met the needs to purchase 321 additional premiums, which means that all the premiums, 100% of the premiums from the spring drive are now paid for and will be shipped out. I also understand BAI's station manager came over and picked up a bunch of premiums, hundreds of premiums yesterday, which is good. So it looks like everything will get out the door, and that was the whole effort. Now we go forward from there. So now we're going to do the program, and for the next couple of days, you'll be hearing original programs. These are not rebroadcast. It's just that this last week, before the storm, knowing I'd probably have to get into the storm and help, you know, my neighbors who have no water, no electricity. No one has electricity down here, with food and other things. So I pre-recorded some programs, some really good programs. So enjoy the programs, and hopefully we'll have electric, which means the internet, which means my radio studio, which is I have my home, so I can go back to live broadcasting, hopefully by Monday. Now to our program for today.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Normally at this time, I would give you the latest on health and healing, anti-aging, then go to environmental information, a guest, frequently a conversation with a remarkable mind. But today, we've gotten such positive feedback of people who want more in-depth information from physicians who have used a healthy diet and lifestyle to help ameliorate, reverse, or sometimes cure conditions that the patient had not been helped with prior to that. Today, we're continuing going to Lombard, Illinois. That's near Chicago, where Dr. Timothy Fior, that's F-I-O-R, who's been practicing integral and complementary family medicine, including using a plant-based diet, meditation, homeopathy, for nearly 30 years, and he is a founding medical partner at the Center for Integral Health in Lombard, that's L-O-M-B-A-R-D, Illinois, and he's been a vegetarian for the same time. He's co-founder and former president of the Illinois Homeopathic Medical Association, and he also has a great deal of writing behind him. And we'll get to his website in a moment so you can look at his background. He's got his medical degree from Michigan State University College of Medicine, and his center's website is centerforintegralhealth.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Good being with you.
When we look at some of the major killers, we're looking at diabetes, stroke, heart disease, Alzheimer's. You're also looking at obesity-related conditions and metabolic syndrome. And then the debilitating conditions, such as arthritis or pro-inflammatory conditions, fatigue and pain. Also, we're looking at Parkinson's, dementia, memory loss, insomnia. Could you please select any of these and show how you work with a patient and be as detailed as you can, and then give us some of the cases that you've seen remarkable improvements, like cancer if you have any, or renal disease. The form is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Gary. Yeah, so as you mentioned, I've been in practice now 29 years. I've been vegetarian, lecto-vegetarian myself for 32 years, and most recently, the last few months, vegan. And, you know, I try and encourage patients. I see, as a family physician, I see patients of all spectrum, children, adults, older people, with all different types of illnesses. And I encourage basically everyone I see to try and adopt a more plant-based diet. And now living in the Midwest, Lombard, Illinois, is a suburb of Chicago, the Midwest, you know, a meat-based diet, animal-based diet, animal protein-based diet is very common, is more the norm. But I encourage patients, no matter what their issues, to eat a more plant-based, whole food, plant-based diet. And I find that those who are able to do it, inevitably, their conditions improve. Let me give you some examples. I have a younger woman who I see who is quite athletic and recently had a baby, and she had a lot of GI issues. And it's very interesting because she grew up vegetarian, but everyone, because she's in the health and fitness kind of arena, that's where she works as a trainer, personal trainer. Everyone encourages her, including her boyfriend, her significant other, to eat meat because that's what healthy people do. And she has so many GI issues when she does that. And I've been encouraging her time and again to get back to her vegetarian roots, her really vegan roots. And whenever she's able to accomplish that, her GI problems basically disappear. She does much better. So this is a kind of a common thing. There's me telling people to try and eat more fruits and vegetables and more of a plant-based diet. And then usually from society, at least in the Midwest, they're getting kind of the other message to eat more of a meat-based diet because that's supposedly healthier, but it's not. You mentioned cancer. I treat quite a few cancer patients these days. Notably, I have a couple patients I'll mention who have lymphoma, which can be kind of a chronic ailment over time. Nowadays, with some of the modern treatments, they can kind of keep it in check. But I found with both these patients that one of them is an elderly gentleman. He's in his, well, elderly, it depends on how old you are, what you consider elderly, but he's in his late 70s, and he's had lymphoma for quite a few years, more than a decade. And he's been vegetarian for most of his life, probably half of his life at least. And after I first saw him a few years back, I encouraged him to become vegan, and he's actually done quite well. He sticks with the vegan diet, and we've done other things with him, homeopathic treatments and such, and he's done quite well. He went through a heart surgery, did really well with that. His wife, at one point, he had complications from some of the medicines he was given for the lymphoma, some of the lighter chemotherapy drugs, and he kind of got through that fine. And so that's, you know, that's one example. I think a plant-based diet, being, and he's been vegetarian for a long time, but being vegan more recently has really helped him. I have another patient who spends most of the year in living in Florida, who used to live here in Illinois, who has lymphoma as well. And basically, when she was diagnosed, I encouraged her to become vegetarian and actually to become vegan. And actually, with all my cancer patients, I'm very strong about that, because epidemiologically, the evidence is very strong that many different cancers, you know, the big cancers, breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, and other lesser cancers, are heavily influenced by diet epidemiologically. And there are even studies now, like I know there are studies in breast cancer, that women who go on a more vegetarian diet have less recurrences of breast cancer. So with her lymphoma, I've encouraged her to be vegan, and she's done really well. She did go through a round of chemotherapy, got through it well. One of the cancer centers was still recommending she get a bone marrow. She got a bone marrow transplant, but she refused. She said, "Look, I'm doing well. I don't need to." And she's done well for many years, just with the vegan diet. We've also been treating her with homeopathy, and so she's done well. You mentioned renal disease. It's very interesting. When people's kidneys start failing, one of the first things that the kidney doctors want to do is tell people to limit their protein. You have to limit the water you drink, you have to limit your salt, and you also have to limit your protein. So it occurred to me, having worked with these kidney doctors, it's like, well, would that limiting protein for people before they go into renal failure, before they need dialysis or transplant, would that be a good thing? So I've actually used the same diet, whole food plant-based diet, mostly a vegan diet, on a couple patients with renal disease, and lo and behold, it works too. I had one gentleman who had high blood pressure. He developed a kidney condition where he was, you know, kidney function was going down. And I encouraged him. He was a very big, his wife is vegetarian, but he's been kind of a meat eater his whole life, trouble with overweight and many other problems. And I really encouraged him. You know, he was kind of heading toward needing dialysis and having kidney failure. I encouraged him to adopt a vegan diet, and he stuck by it. And his kidney function has actually improved. He went back to the kidney doctor, and the kidney doctor, looking at his numbers, are these right? This is for you. And in fact, it was him, and his numbers had improved largely because of the vegan diet. I have another patient who has kidney disease, and she's older, and she's very, you know, she's moving toward being vegetarian and or vegan. And she's done very well with her kidney disease. It's been stable for many years, and now she's in her 80s, and the kidney doctor is like, well, maybe you'll never need to go on dialysis. And I think the diet has been a big part of that. You know, it's really kind of sad, because when I went to medical school, we weren't taught any of this. We were taught, you know, drugs, surgery, radiation, chemo. These are the treatments you use. And it wasn't until after I graduated and I started looking around and meeting people and learning other things that I started finding out that, you know what, diet can be one of the most powerful factors in improving health for people, and that most of the diseases now that people have, like you mentioned, heart disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes, autoimmune diseases, most of these things are influenced by diet and by other things in our environment. And if you can clean up your diet, and this is what I recommend for many, many of my patients, if they can clean up their diet, it doesn't matter what condition, chronic condition they have, most often they feel improvements.
When you look at the average person's diet, tell us what you're seeing. And then, what would you consider the dirty dozen foods or beverages people should not have? And then what would you consider your plant-based superstars?
Great question, Gary. So what I see people eating is too much animal stuff, you know, too much meat, fish, chicken. It's very interesting. Chicken is especially associated with certain illnesses like lymphoma. Why that is, I don't know. At some point, maybe we'll figure it out. But each of these things is associated with different problems. Fish, it's come to a lot of people's attention lately that fish is associated with higher mercury levels. It's very interesting. Where does the mercury come from? And you might be familiar with RFK Jr.'s work. He's been working for years trying to make coal-burning plants accountable because of their mercury pollution. They burn the coal, and it gets into the atmosphere, the mercury, then it comes down in rain, and the microorganisms eat it, and the little fish and the bigger fish, and then it accumulates in bigger fish. And then if you're eating tuna and other large fish, you're eating significant amounts of mercury. So dairy, there's issues with dairy. I mean, dairy is a perfect food for, you know, calves, but for people, it's very high in fat and protein. And it's an issue. It leads to obesity and many other problems. So, you know, these are the foods that I see kind of the typical American diet. And but it's interesting. I think people are becoming more aware that there's another way to eat. There's a healthier way to eat. And what I encourage people to do is to try and add on more fruits and vegetables. And you know, my favorite, you know, things when I give lectures on diet, I kind of, you know, I haven't really created anything new here. There's many different authors who are talking about this now, a whole food plant-based diet. There's Colin Campbell with his China study and the Campbell plan. There's Joel Fuhrman with his books Eat to Live and many other books. Convalescent Systems Research and his books. Dean Ornish. Many other people are writing about this now. Michael Greger. And as far as the superstars in terms of, you know, a plant-based diet, one acronym I like to use that's easy to remember is the Green Bombs from Joel Fuhrman's books. And the Green Bombs are greens. And he talks about a nutritarian diet where we try and eat more on a high nutrient level foods that are the highest in vitamins, minerals, antioxidants and other phytonutrients, which are very beneficial to our bodies and prevent cancer and heart disease and all these other things. And greens are at the top of the list. So every day for lunch, I have a green salad, and I encourage people eat salad and, you know, with greens and kale and lettuce and spinach, whatever else you can. So greens, and then beans would be next, and then onions, mushrooms. It's very interesting. There's many different mushrooms, and people have cancer that have these mushrooms have many different phytochemicals which are protective of cancer and actually can help treat cancer. Greens, beans, onions, mushrooms, seeds, and berries. And I would also include in that spices and herbs. It's very interesting. The way plants evolved is, you know, animals can, when we eat animal-based foods, they mainly have, what we get out of it is protein and fat and, you know, maybe a little bit of iron and maybe a little bit of B12, but maybe a little calcium from the milk, but not a lot of other nutrients. When we eat plants, the plants have evolved because they can't move. If there's a predator there, they're sitting, kind of, in a sense, sitting ducks, although they're not ducks. So what the plants have evolved is these different chemicals that they create, these different phytochemicals, that often, like the carotenoids, which give the bright orange and red colors to different fruits and vegetables, the flavonoids, many other antioxidants, many other phytochemicals that really protect them from their predators, from viruses, bacteria, fungus. And these are the same chemicals, when we eat them, they basically protect us from cancer, heart disease, and they basically strengthen our bodies, and our bodies need these things. And there's a lot of these chemicals now, or we're finding out they're even using some of these chemicals to treat cancer, infusions of some of these chemicals to treat cancer now. But the main thing is to get them from, you know, get them from foods first as a prevention. That's what I encourage all my patients to do.
Okay, what is the biggest stumbling block, or what challenges the person that they just can't seem to get beyond?
Well, I think the biggest stumbling block to adopting a more plant-based diet is how you were raised and then the people around you. you know, when you all of a sudden become vegetarian and everyone else at your table is a meat eater, it's a little, I mean, I went through that phase. I've been vegetarian for 32 years. And at first, my family kind of looked at me like, well, you know, I grew up eating meat two, three times a day. And then I just felt, just kind of naturally, I felt that, you know, after eating a big steak on a Sunday afternoon, I couldn't function. I just wanted to go and take a nap. You know, you look at the carnivores, the lions and stuff, they go and they catch their food and then they sleep the rest of the time. You know, so I found that naturally I started eating more vegetarian and I had some skin issues, acne and things like that. The more I ate more greens, fruits, vegetables, especially greens, salads, just taking all these medications and stuff. But really it's when I went on a more vegetarian diet, that's when my health problems improved and my skin improved and other, I could see my mental acuity was better. So I think, you know, family is how we were brought up is a big thing. But also maybe even more important is the groups of people that were around. Luckily my wife and I were a member of a group, a church, where we're all vegetarian. So it's easy for us. We go out with our friends and we're all eating vegetarian and it's no big deal. But I think for most people, especially in the Midwest and maybe other parts of the country, other parts of the world, that's difficult because their friends are all, it's like, oh, it's, you know, let's go to a steakhouse, let's go to a seafood place, and, you know, places like that, it's still hard to get a vegetarian meal. Most other places you can get a salad, something vegetarian, vegetables. It's interesting. We see a lot of people from other countries like India where maybe they were raised vegetarian, but they come here to Chicago, and it's you can see they get pulled into that going in eating meat because the culture here is so, you know, so meat oriented. And but it's interesting. I think it's really changing. The options for vegetarian food are getting to be, even in the Midwest, are getting to be more and more. And people are getting to be more and more health conscious. They're realizing that a lot of their health problems are because of what they eat. And then because of nice movies like Forks Over Knives, it's like, you know, it's, you can get a bypass surgery or you can change your diet, like Dean Ornish and Cobble Esselstyn have shown. And people are saying, wait a minute, do I want my chest cracked open, my heart stopped, put on a bypass machine, or would I rather change my diet? Well, let me try that, the diet change. That sounds a lot more, a lot simpler than having the surgery and all the possible complications and the recovery from that.
Why is it that there are only about 200 to 300 physicians out of 900,000 physicians using a plant-based diet as one of the modalities in their healing practice?
Well, Gary, that's an excellent question. Why aren't there more physicians advocating a plant-based diet? I think the problem is it gets back to society and it gets back to education. And I'll tell you, when I went to medical school in the 80s, we had one lecture on nutrition. It was a pediatric nephrologist. A pediatric kidney doctor stood in front of our class and said, nutrition, okay. Go to McDonald's, you'll get everything you need. I kid you not, that's what he told us. That was our lecture on nutrition.
Really?
And I kid you not.
Go to McDonald's?
And we all looked at the students, we all looked at each other and said, this guy might be a brilliant kidney doctor, but it was obvious to all of us he didn't know the first thing about nutrition. So we got basically no education on nutrition. The problem with medical education nowadays, from what I see, the pharmaceutical influence is so strong that's where all the funding comes from. That's where all the education, that's where all the instructors, the teachers make money on grants and stuff by researching drugs and different procedures and stuff. And so that's where the emphasis is put because that's where the money is. But, you know, diet, how we eat, is so integral to health. I mean, Hippocrates recognized it in B.C., like 400 B.C. He said, let food be your medicine. And we have come so far away from that. And I went into medical school already being mostly vegetarian. I had friends who were vegetarian. I was kind of going along those lines. I didn't finally become vegetarian until 1985 during medical school. But you know, it's like so few physicians. We're not trained in it at all. It's just not. There's no. I guess there's no money to be made by training people to what is a good diet. And so, you know, that's just not part of the education process. But there are more physicians. In our group, we have quite a few physicians. We're all vegetarian, and we give talks. Our meditation group also has a festival every year for the last 12 years. It's called Veggie Fest, where we promote a vegetarian diet, mostly a lacto-vegetarian diet. But this year, for the first time in 12 years, every food booth that we had had a vegan option. And it was interesting. The vegan options sold out first. Those are the ones that sold out first. And when we started doing this fair about 12 years ago, we had a couple thousand people that came. It's usually held in Naperville, Lisle, Illinois. This year it was in Lisle. And this year it's worked up to, we had over 45,000 people who came to this festival. So you can see, I can see just through the years, the more and more people are interested. I think more physicians are getting the picture. We had two physicians from very prominent physicians in Chicago who lectured. Kim Williams, who's a cardiologist at Rush University, one of the most prestigious universities here in Chicago. He was a former president of the American College of Cardiology in 2015-16. He's a vegan, and he lectures all over the world on vegetarian diet. So there are some people out there who are some physicians, but you're right. It's kind of it's growing, but it's I think the people who are doing it out of their conscience and looking at the research and seeing it's good. But unfortunately, right now there's not any incentives for physicians to be recommending vegetarian diets. I can remember after I was at a hospital meeting, we had a cardiologist come in and talk to us shortly after Dean Ornish's research on reversing heart disease with a vegetarian diet came out, and I mean, I was very impressed by the study. I thought, oh my God, he's actually reversing it, and you know, that's great. You know, he showed spec scans and everything. It was very, you know, the facts were all there, the data was all there, and it was very interesting because I saw the cardiologist, and he mentioned the study, and then he had a caveat. He said, well, but you know, people won't really do this. And then it struck me. I'm sure he has no success getting people with heart disease to eat a vegetarian diet. And the reason is, he doesn't do it himself. You know, physicians, we're supposed to be teachers. We have to teach people how to be healthier and to improve their health. But we have to emulate what we're trying to teach our patients. I'm vegetarian. I encourage all my patients to be vegetarian. But I realized what this cardiologist was saying is, nah, I'm not going to give up my steak and my chicken and my fish. So, and my, you know, ice cream every night. So I don't think any of my patients will either, so I'm not going to advocate it. But you look at doctors like Dean Ornish, who is vegetarian, Caldwell Esselstyn, who's vegetarian, vegan. For them, it works because they're being truthful. They're being honest with their patients. They're saying, look, I've done it. I want you to do it. And with my patients, it's the same thing. Patients are smart. If you can remember, when I was a resident, he had a physician who was smoking his head off, and he'd go into the room of a patient who just had a heart attack and say, well, you need to quit smoking. And the patient could smell the smoke on his breath. He's going to go, yeah, right, you can't quit. Why am I going to quit? We have to be physicians. I think we have to be good examples and be honest to patients. And luckily, I think there's getting to be more and more physicians. It's slow, but I think sometimes the truth moves slowly, you know? There's market forces that kind of move things in a different direction, but the truth, I think, is growing and moving slowly in this direction.
I just have one larger issue I'd like for you to address, if you would, please. And that is, all of medicine today prides itself on being science-based. Fine. So I took a look at the scientific literature, over 5,000 hours of research on just this very topic, and I simply looked at two different sets of statistics. How many studies exist showing that what we eat on an everyday diet, hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, pizzas, colas, coffee, grilled cheese sandwiches, ice cream, alcohol, how many studies in the peer-reviewed literature show that by consuming these in the amounts we do, that it will improve our health? It'll help our heart, our gums, our teeth, our eyes, reduce oxidative stress, reduce inflammation. I couldn't find a single article, not one. Then I did the same identical study, but I looked at a plant-based diet, a healthy plant-based diet. You mentioned earlier in our conversation the cruciferous. So I looked at broccoli, cauliflower, kale, watercress, you know, radishes. I looked at herbs like turmeric and basil and oregano and mints. I looked at onions and garlic. I looked at ginseng and curcumin. And I looked at the superfoods like chlorella, spirulina. I looked at the benefits of this diet. I found over 3,000 studies on the health benefits, major studies, including the nurses' studies and the doctor's studies, multiple Mediterranean diet studies, multiple studies published online through the vegan program out at Loma Linda University. So on the one hand, we have thousands of studies in the peer-reviewed literature that withstand all criticism for objectivity, and we have zero studies on the average doctor-supported diet, patient-supported diet. Now, there is a cognitive disconnect here, and I think someone has to have the courage to bring it out and say, how in the world can you say that you have science-based medicine and you're promoting disease? And you should be promoting what Dean Ornish did. But when Dean Ornish did his study, I was on PBS in a debate with him. He and I were on the same side against a whole group of cardiologists who didn't believe in this. He published in The Lancet, later in the New England Journal of Medicine. He was able to show by his study, and I interviewed the patients at the time, he was able to reverse the diseases that the cardiologist says you could not reverse. But he did reverse them. So could you address this whole idea that the actual science shows we should be doing just the opposite of what we're doing?
Well, Gary, that's, you know, that exact same point has bothered me for decades now. And, you know, it's a bit hard to understand, but I think a way to understand it is, you know, sure, there's evidence-based medicine. Sometimes some people turn it evidence-biased medicine, because who can generate evidence? To do a randomized controlled trial, which is considered the gold standard of evidence, is expensive. And Dean Ornish has done one. I think Carl Esselstyn has done a couple with a few hundred people. So the research says, oh, you need more research, right? But who can generate the money? Who has the money to do the research? Generally, that money is with the pharmaceutical companies, because if they have a blockbuster drug, they make $1 billion or more dollars a year. I mean, at one point, one of the statin drugs was making, I think, up to $17 billion in global sales a year. That's a lot of money to spend on research, although they probably spend more money on advertising than they spend on research. So there's so much research out there, and a lot of it is kind of really disease-oriented research that really doesn't apply to patients. All this nutritional research that you mentioned, thousands of studies. I have a database I'm keeping as well, and I look at Michael Greger's website, and I'm reading his book, How Not to Die Now, and thousands of references, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of references. There's so much evidence on how eating affects our health, and we can improve our health by changing our diet. The problem is, you know, doctors are not really researchers. They're not experts on research. In any one given field, there are probably hundreds of thousands of studies, and it's like no one can keep on track of all that. Unless you're a researcher yourself, then you keep track of research in one very narrow field. Medicine has become very reductionistic. And what happens is, doctors are, you know, I think doctors come into medicine, I know I did, you know, you come in with this idea, you want to help people, and you want to do what's good for people's health, but you very quickly become overwhelmed with the magnitude of disease and illness and people having heart attacks and dying in front of you. I mean, a lot of doctors, like myself included, end up with post-traumatic stress from seeing dozens and dozens of people die right in front of you, and you have to try and resuscitate them, and it doesn't work. And, you know, so we're overwhelmed. There's so much data. In one lifetime, you cannot master that data. It's not possible. And so what happens? In medicine, what we do is we look at our teachers, and we do what they did. And what do? They do what their teachers did, and so on and so on and so on. So it's tradition. It's clinical experience, which is passed down from person to person to person. And unfortunately, that only changes very slowly. And because in medical education, there's no emphasis on nutrition, none. Now, this is where I have to give a kudos. I actually teach at National University here locally in Lombard, where they have a naturopathic program. And the naturopaths are taught determinants of health, and nutrition is one of the big determinants of health. So they have that part. In conventional medical education, that has been removed. And so doctors don't know anything about it. They're learned. They taught to practice a certain way. Oh, if you're a heart doctor, you know, cardiologist, you do put in stents. That's how you make a living. That's how you put your kids through college. Changing their diet, well, I'm not going to do it. So my patients aren't going to do it. That's the attitude you have. And it's a tradition. It changes very slowly. And
there's a reason
the only
why.
Physicians
let me just
who are able to get out of that box are physicians who are willing to do research on their own, independent research, and maybe change their own lifestyle. And, you know, then they realize, well, wait a minute, you know, and the more I practice, the more I see, it's these things like diet, exercise, meditation. If people do this from a young age on, they can circumvent many of these illnesses. And if they have illnesses, if they do these things, they can make these things much better and end up being on less medication, having less side effects, and doing much better. And if you don't do any of those things and just eat a conventional medical American diet, like you said, hamburgers and french fries, you're going to die young.
I appreciate your insights. There's one last comment I'd like to make. The newest scientific study showed that it wouldn't matter how good the gold standard of a scientific outcome was. People are also indoctrinated to a degree that they have to hold on to that belief long beyond when it should have been surrendered. And that's not just true in medicine. That's true in so many other areas of our life. And so then one day you wake up and think, wow, you mean back in the 21st century, people are actually still eating animals?
Yeah.
How unevolved. But look, it takes 30 years after a medical procedure is shown to not be beneficial and harmful before it's finally surrendered completely to the junk heap of medical heresy. So you're on the right side of truth and people's health on this, and thank you very much for all the good work you're doing. We look forward to another conversation.
All right, Gary, thank you so much.
That was Dr. Timothy Fiora, F-I-O-R. He is out in Lombard, Illinois. His center is the Center for IntegralHealth.com. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is a special presentation on how to live a longer, healthier life, how to prevent and reverse diseases, even the possibility of curing conditions that most of mainstream medicine considers treatable but not reversible, just trying to maintain symptoms. Well, and then you can live a lifetime, decades, on multiple medications. I just counseled a person last week that was on 24 different medications. Half of those medications were to cover the side effects of the other medications. At no point did the person say, my doctor said, maybe I should just change my diet, start to cleanse and detoxify, rebuild my immune system. Nothing. And that is the unfortunate part. So we're going to get another perspective on this. We're going to Baltimore, Maryland. We're standing by as Dr. Paul Giles, G-I-L-E-S, and he is a specialist in family medical practice, family practitioner. And he also has a background in molecular biology and with degrees from the University of Texas, and also a doctorate, and also from the University of North Carolina, Texas Health Sciences Center, and he also specializes in sports medicine. Nice to have you with us today, Paul.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Paul, let's begin first with just a question about yourself. Have you ever faced any medical condition in your own life or your family's life that the tools you were trained to use simply were not adequate to the task and you had to go outside of that paradigm to bring in some additional tools, and then what was the outcome, if that in any way applies to you?
I have not had any significant medical concerns in my own life that were not able to be addressed by Western medicine, and I've had a very blessed life in general with very few interactions with the healthcare system prior to going to medical school.
Okay, then what opened you up to the idea that such things as a more healthier diet and exercise and stress management could make a difference in a person's health?
I don't think I'm unique in most of America in feeling that pharmaceutics, to some degree, get out of control, and wanting to be empowered to take control of my own health. Being in medicine and doing the education, I've had a lot of exposure to the research that is used to make basis for recommendations that physicians provide. And in medical school, many of the conditions they teach us about, the very first step in treating the condition is discussed making therapeutic lifestyle changes. But because those are the same for every condition, we hear about it once, and then for the rest of our medical training, we're told about the unique pharmaceutics that are used for each condition. And there seems to be very little known about the effects of diet and exercise. It was the main reason I went to do a sports medicine fellowship, was learning about the use of exercise to treat arthritis and to deal with diabetes and a number of other chronic conditions.
Let's just take an example of four conditions that most Americans will either face in their own life or someone they love will face: being overweight, having some form of diabetic or pre-diabetic or metabolic syndrome condition, high blood pressure, and also pain. For those four very common situations, could you tell us some of the results, positive results, that you've been able to obtain in your patients, including reversal of those conditions, and how you got there?
So I have done a lot of education on my own. One of my major sources would be the nutritionfacts.org or Dr. Grieger, who has compilated a lot of evidence-based research behind dietary changes. And it's inspired me and emboldened me to make these specific recommendations to my patients. And a very excellent example I had was a relatively young gentleman who is incredibly motivated. He was in his mid to late 30s, and he came back with elevated blood sugar and an A1C that was above 6.5, which was diagnostic for diabetes. He had two markers. He received the diagnosis. I told him he was diabetic. He was young. This was the first diagnosis, and this was the time where I needed to indicate that it's a dietary disease and lifestyle changes can take control. It's not his fault he had diabetes, but it's his responsibility to take care of it. I gave him resources to learn about dietary changes, and I talked about regular exercise and management of an overall healthy weight, referencing a BMI as a good, if not perfect, gauge. And he returned to me after 3 to 4 months, having made significant changes to his therapeutic lifestyle. He had gone from maybe working out once a week to working out 6 days a week for about 45 minutes to an hour. He had completely changed his diet. He had removed all of the animal products. He had removed most, if not all, of the refined food products from his diet, and his A1C was perfectly normal, and his blood pressure had normalized as well. It was impressive for me to see such a drastic change, and it's definitely left an impression on me. I have not seen him since that appointment. I don't know if he's continued with this lifestyle or not, but I have seen the lifestyle work. There are a number of other times with other patients who have made the lifestyle change, seen a decrease in my use of their medications or improvement of their overall numbers, if not complete reversal of disease. They get lost to follow-up. They'll come back to me. I recheck them, and their sugar has again become elevated. I remind them of the therapeutic lifestyle changes. They go back to the changes, and the numbers improve. So I definitely see significant improvement in markers of diabetes, blood pressure. Weight is often a side effect. I don't tend to sell a whole food plant-based diet or discuss and counsel a whole food plant-based diet solely for the purposes of weight loss. There are a number of ways you can lose weight, but it's a very difficult lifestyle change to make in our current society with food culture the way it is and the way our families generally celebrate and we deal with stress. It's a significant change to your lifestyle, not just what you eat, but when you go out with your friends, when you meet for Thanksgiving, when you go out for a barbecue over the summer. Making such a change will certainly separate you to some degree from your normal peer group. And not many people are willing to make that all the way change. It is a struggle that I have with my patients, and those who are able to get closer to a whole food plant-based diet get much better results.
Give us some examples of a program, as specifically as you can, to help people first with heart disease, and if there's any change if you're helping someone, let's say, with diabetes or losing weight.
So I start with the education. Because of the difficulty of making a change in your entire life, I need to have a buy-in. You need to understand the power of making the dietary change. There are then a number of ways you can do it. There is some research out there to show that if you're able to make a 100% switch for 21 days or 3 weeks, you are more likely to stay with that change going forward. To explain that, it would be some people want to negotiate the giving up of their favorite foods. They will all give up red meat, but I'll still have chicken and fish and cheese. You know, and so they'll give up the red meat for 3 weeks, so they feel like they're doing without. And then maybe they want to take something else out, and then something else away. And eventually you lose the motivation, or that's what I've seen in my practice, to where you're spending months to a year of constantly feeling like you're living without something. If you're able to force yourself to get through 21 days of that feeling of loss, of giving up food that you love, after those 21 days, those cravings go away, and you no longer miss all of those foods that you were missing.
Yes. Hello?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yeah. Now, what reliance do you have on supplementation, if at all?
So a whole food plant-based diet is inherently deficient in vitamin B12. So you do need to supplement with vitamin B12.
All right. And anything else?
I will screen for vitamin D deficiency, and that's mostly about a westernized industrial environment where most people spend a majority of their life indoors and away from the sun. And so the natural mechanisms by which the body creates vitamin D, which is UV radiation to the skin, is lost. And so a large majority of us are deficient in vitamin D, so I will screen for that as well.
When you're looking at all the patients you see, and I'm assuming you've counseled thousands of patients, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Then what percentage of them who adhere as you have requested them to adhere, have you seen major results in the reversal of these diseases?
So a very small percentage of my patients to whom I counsel can make the change. Those that do make the change, I have seen incredible, almost difficult to believe results. I have another gentleman who I see twice a year who has had a cardiac stent placed, was on high-dose cholesterol medication, which is the protocol when a stent is placed. He was on blood-thinning agents. He was on an agent to control his blood pressure and protect his heart. And he was also on another blood pressure medication. He actually found the dietary intervention on his own and was very motivated in doing the research himself when he came to me, and I was very familiar with it and supported him wholeheartedly in his endeavors to make these changes. And he's also worked with his cardiologist, who is also familiar with the power of a whole food plant-based diet. And he now is off all of his cardiac medications. He has no blood thinners. His beta blocker was removed, and his cholesterol medication was removed because his cholesterol was so low. His total cholesterol was less than 100, and his LDL was less than 50. The medication was no longer driving his cholesterol down. And after, I think it might have taken about a year or so for his cardiologist and myself to sort of feel it was comfortable to take the medication off, try a medication holiday, and see what happened to the labs 6 or so weeks out, and see if the levels of the laboratory that we monitored were able to be maintained.
Hmm. That's terrific. Now, you mentioned that only a small percentage of your patients are willing to or can adhere to the protocols. What are the primary reasons they give you for not being able to do it?
It is a drastic change from a standard American diet. It is also not something that can be left to the last minute. For shelter, food, and clothing being the three most important things to maintain life, they are all things that are generally put on the back burner. In our food culture, you don't have to think about food until you're hungry, and then you can go out and buy it cheaply within minutes and even have it delivered to your house. That is not the case for whole food, plant-based meals. They're not readily available at restaurants and fast food places, so you pretty much need to cook all of your own food. So the first barrier is to convince people to start the habit of cooking, which they may not even know how to do. So learning the recipes and then investing the time in prepping foods, eating the food, washing the dishes, it requires a back to basics form of living. And if you're still in a high-paced lifestyle, there are some cheats and recommendations I would do about investment in your health. I would recommend, if you're very, very busy, to spend 1 or 2 hours a week on the weekend to sit down and decide what do you want to eat, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack, for the next 7 days. Make out an entire plan so that you're not stuck on a Wednesday afternoon. You're driving home from work. You don't know what you're going to eat for dinner that night. You don't know what you have in the kitchen. Oh, look, there is a fast food restaurant I can see. I'll just pick something up and take it home quick and easy. Instead, you have already made your plan 4 days ago. You know what you're going to eat, and the food is already there. Once you have made your plan, you can develop a grocery list that you can reference with your kitchen to find out what else do you need to buy. You go to the grocery store and you buy only the things on your list. Try to control those impulse buys while you're in the grocery store. And then when you come home, to make things even faster, it's a concept of batch cooking, where you look at all of your recipes. And planning to have leftovers from Monday be your lunch on Tuesday is perfectly appropriate. In addition to that, if three of your recipes require a diced onion, then on Sunday, go ahead and dice three onions and just put them in your refrigerator so that they're ready to go. And you end up looking like a TV chef during the week. You just take out all the pre-prepped food, you throw it all together, you heat it up, in 20 minutes you got dinner. But it does take investment earlier in the week to plan out what are you going to eat for the next 7 days and have all of that food ready. And these are habits that I don't think we have in modern society.
That's good advice. And you are correct. Most people are conditioned to a certain mouthfeel, a taste, a fullness level. And if they're changing a diet that doesn't have the same taste, consistency, mouthfeel, then they could resist that. So that's good. Finally, what would be the lesson that you would share with physicians who are not familiar at all with a plant-based diet, would have never seen the, as you mentioned, remarkable, almost unbelievable results with some patients? What would you say to them as to why they should consider this?
Again, I like to lead with a call to intellect. I would like to bring to them the research that is available and the governing bodies that have agreed that a whole food plant-based is the way to go. And I could also give the anecdotal evidence of my patients who have made the change. But I would actually challenge most physicians to make the change themselves. As, you know, a patient who smokes is less likely to stop smoking when a physician who is smoking in front of them tells them to quit, I feel that physicians gain a great deal of authority when making this type of a dietary change if they themselves are following it.
I would agree with that. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights with us today.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Paul Gilas, my guest, I'm Gary Noll.